Good morning. This is W.W. Chaplin in the NBC newsroom in New York, bringing you your world news roundup with direct reports from overseas. Infantry of the American Third Army has deepened the Saar bridgehead. It's driven forward a whole mile in the region of Saarlouten. The Allied communique describes enemy opposition there as strong. The enemy recognizes the pattern threat and is trying to meet it. The British Second Army has now cleared the Germans from the entire area west of the Meuse River in Holland. And there are indications that the deadlock in Italy may be breaking up. The famous British Eighth Army down there has moved suddenly forward, cut the Ravenna-Bologna railway, straddled the main highway between those cities, and captured two smaller towns. From the Pacific comes word of a sharp naval clash in Ormoc Gulf, off Leyte, in which we and the Japs each lost a destroyer. In London, Prime Minister Churchill told the House of Commons this morning that Britain will not hesitate to use its armed forces to maintain law and order in riot-ridden Greece. And now, a few words from your announcer.
97,000 killed in 1 year, 10 million hurt, $5 billion lost. That's the toll taken by wartime accidents, accidents that could be prevented. Accidents are costly any time, but in wartime they're doubly costly when we need all our available manpower and materials. But accidents can be prevented if we all remember the ABCs of safety in traffic, at home, on the job, and on the farm. For instance, in traffic, observe all speed and traffic regulations, be sure that your car is in safe operating condition, and be ready to stop quickly for children who may run in your path. As a pedestrian, make sure that streets and highways are safe. Now here's W.W. Chaplin and your World News Roundup.
The situation in Greece is increasingly grave, and it begins to look now as if only Allied diplomacy approaching the stroke of genius level can avert civil war. Allied diplomacy in Greece up to this point seems to many to have been considerably below that level. The easy way out in reaching a personal conclusion as to the rights and wrongs involved is, of course, just to accept the leftist and rightist tags which have been applied to the opposing Grecian groups. The easy way is to say, well, we don't like communism, and so the rightist party in power must be right. But I think that's too easy. So easy, it's just plain wrong. Perhaps the recalcitrant group in Spain is a mere far-left minority. Perhaps that's true of the southern France recalcitrants. Perhaps. But it almost certainly is not true in Greece. From evidence at hand, the so-called leftist National Liberation Front in Greece may not be a minority at all, for one thing. It at least claims to represent a majority of Greeks, demanding a republican democracy instead of a monarchy colored by ultra-conservatives. Also, all the evidence we have points to the fact that this present so-called rightist government was put in power out of hand by outside interests. And by outside interests, I mean particularly Britain, which has at least been outspoken. But I haven't heard any official protests from America either. We haven't stationed American tanks in the streets of Athens, as the British have. We haven't told the Greek liberals, who fought as guerrillas all through the period of occupation, we haven't told them to get out of their own capital city, as the British have, but we haven't done anything visible or audible either to assure the Greeks, all the Greeks, of the right to have the kind of government that they want, instead of one brought in from outside and superimposed there. I notice from today's dispatches that these so-called leftists are now in control of 20 of the 25 police precincts in Athens, and that they have defied the order to disband, the order issued by the British-supported government of Premier Papandreou. In other words, the big Western powers have in this instance failed as international busybodies and have merely succeeded in stirring up a hornet's nest. What we need now, and need quickly, is a touch of diplomacy at least approaching the wisdom which has been displayed throughout by our military leaders. We need an Eisenhower of diplomacy. And now for our first report from overseas, NBC in the Pacific.
This is Pat Flaherty speaking from the Philippines. Among the several firsts associated with the invasion of the Philippines is the Mobile Fleet Post Office, number one of the United States Navy. I visited this unit on A+3 and found the advance man reserving a building for permanent quarters and putting up appropriate signs. Before he had finished, mail clerks from ships in the harbor were bringing in their pouches of mail. On A+4, the combat naval postal crew moved up from their beachhead location, and within 12 hours, they had the full facilities of a fleet post office in operation. Lieutenant Commander Joseph L. Badger, postal officer, Philippine Sea Frontier, United States Navy, of Wellesley Hills, Boston, Massachusetts, told me that Admiral Bobby regards mail as a high morale booster. All ships of the 7th Fleet Amphibious Command have orders to report to the fleet post office before sailing from any port to pick up and transport mail going their way. Mr. Badger told me that mail was dispatched to ships in the Philippine convoy in San Pedro Bay and Leyte Gulf on A+1. While fighting was in progress on shore, small mail boats were plying the waters, making these mail deliveries. Lieutenant Junior Grade Price Albertson of San Pedro, California, officer in charge of the combat postal crew, told me several interesting facts about his unit. One was a most encouraging item, proof that the men are not spending the bulk of their money for the questionable bargains being offered by the tiendas of Tacloban. Over a period of 30 days, 3,814 post office money orders totaling over $250,000 were issued by Mobile Fleet Post Office No. 1. About that time, Chief Petty Officer Ernest J. Lagomarsino of San Francisco, California, chief mailman of the crew, piped up, "The CBs don't have anything on us. We come ashore under combat conditions, armed and prepared to operate in the open, under tents, or in a building setup like we have here." Pat Flaherty speaking from the Philippines and returning you to NBC in New York.
That was our report on the fighting, the situation generally in the far Philippines and way out in the Pacific. Now for our second direct report from overseas, we take you to the European battlefront. We call in NBC on the Western Front.
This is James Cassidy with the American First Army on the German frontier. This morning, American anti-aircraft gunners east of Aachen are itching for another chance at the Luftwaffe. They are elated by the announcement that more than 60% of the German strafing planes, which came over this army front 2 days ago, were shot down. And littered all the way across the front are the charred skeletons of Focke-Wulfs and Messerschmitts to prove that fact. Today, however, it looks as if the remarkable men of the anti-aircraft batteries will have to rest on their laurels. The sun is out today on this section of the Western Front, and for hours now, American fighter bombers have been out on support missions for our infantry. The appearance of American fighter aircraft is almost a sure sign that the Luftwaffe will stay on the ground. On the ground, meantime, a quiet night was punctuated by a German counterattack involving infantry and Tiger tanks that flared up against our forces southeast of Lucheberg. The attack started at 6 a.m., but was broken up by American artillery fire within a short time. So far on this front, there have not been signs of a large-scale counterattack by the Germans. This is in spite of the fact that since the Siegfried breakthrough in September, von Rundstedt has increased his forces on the Western Front from an estimated 280,000 men to an estimated 500,000 men. The Rohr River, the little stream whose western edge is now controlled by the 9th Army to the north, and whose edges the 1st Army is now approaching, may be the critical spot. Once our forces are across this river, which is really a creek, in sufficient strength to be considered a good target by von Rundstedt, he may choose to launch a full-scale attack. A German blow before that time is improbable, because the Germans would have as much trouble getting across the Ruhr to hit our side as we presumably will have in getting at them on the other side. In addition to those troops which he has given definite assignments on this side of the Rhine, the German commander is also believed to have an armored infantry reserve, good troops with good equipment, which he can move to any sector where he believes an Allied threat developing. Half a million German troops on the Western Front may sound like a hard force to penetrate, but it should be remembered that since November 16th, the First Army alone has destroyed the equivalent of six German divisions, numbering better than 40,000 men. I switch you now to NBC in Washington.
This is Leif Eade in Washington. This morning you can get almost any reaction you want to the big shuffle at the State Department. That the new appointments are both good and bad, strong and weak, and finally that the man behind the whole business is Harry Hopkins. The Hopkins angle is this, that he and Ed Stettinius and Will Clayton and Nelson Rockefeller have worked together for a long time as a close team in top administration circles, which may be good or bad according to whether you like the Hopkins brand of politics. But Joseph C. Grew, as the new undersecretary, brings the know-how of international politics he's learned in 40 years in our embassies and legations in both Europe and the Orient. New Assistant Secretary Clayton, who was the world's biggest cotton broker, puts new emphasis on post-war economic relations. He'll report direct to the president on the hot subject of international aviation, probably to save possible embarrassment to Stettinius, whose brother-in-law happens to be Juan Tripp, president of Pan American Airways. Rockefeller's appointment to an assistant secretaryship means he'll keep on with his Latin America relations work, but this time inside the State Department. Archie MacLeish, the poetry writing librarian of Congress, is the surprise. He's going to be assistant secretary in charge of public and cultural relations, which could mean he's going to do a publicity job at home for the stiffly correct diplomats and head up what's going to be kept of OWI after the war's over. A foreign propaganda job. Anyway, here are some conclusions Washington's drawn up so far. First, that Stettinius has his own men in the State Department, that he won't be clashing with such pronounced personalities as Adolph Burley and Breckinridge Long. Second, that keeping Assistant Secretary Dean Acheson on as State Department liaison man with Congress means that the administration is going to try hard to sell its international program to Capitol Hill. And third, that more and more the president's going to be his own Secretary of State, surrounded by a bunch of crack administrators. This is Leif Eade in Washington, returning you now to New York.
We've heard this morning direct reports from Pat Flaherty in the Philippines, James Cassidy on the Western Front, and just now Leif Eade talking to us from Washington. Now, here's your announcer, and then I'll be back.
The billions of dollars now in the hands of American families may well mean the difference between a sound, prosperous America and an America caught fast in the grip of ruinous inflation. If we save these dollars that are flowing freely today, we guarantee a good future for ourselves and the nation. If we spend them foolishly, use them to bid against each other for scarce goods, we pave the way for higher prices and for empty pocketbooks. The solution? Save. But save with a plan. Plan savings with definite amounts of your income allotted to war bonds, insurance, and saving accounts will protect your family against the leaner days that may come. It will enable your family to buy the things they'll want after the war, the things that have been wearing out these past few years, like radios, refrigerators, and automobiles. Plan your savings now and figure it out with pencil and paper. Save every surplus dollar. Now here again is W.W. Chaplin in the NBC newsroom.
And here we come to our questions. First, Mrs. R.L. McComb of Plant City, Florida. She asks if the Finance Corp operating in the war theaters is a federal or privately owned corporation. That's a misunderstanding which many might have. Actually, that corp doesn't mean corporation at all. It's corps, like an army corps. It's a complete word, not an abbreviation. And the finance corps is very much a part of our army. A very important part when payday rolls around. And here's Mr. Hugh Guy of Kingsport, Tennessee, who says if two boys in service in different outfits in Europe want to write to each other, they both have APO addresses, care of Postmaster New York, of course. Do their letters have to come way over to New York and go back again, wasting shipping space? No, the Army Post Office over there knows the place indicated by each APO number, and the letters go direct. This is W.W. Chaplin saying goodbye from the newsroom in New York.
This is the National Broadcasting Company.